I'm Sarah Baslin-Millar, partner in and chair of Drinker, Biddle & Reith's Employee Benefits and Executive Compensation Practice. Welcome to DBR's new podcast series, ERISA at 45. During this series, we will explore how ERISA and related laws have impacted the employee benefits landscape and what you should be thinking about in the months and years ahead. Today, I'm speaking with Kim Jones, a partner in our Chicago office, and we are talking about retirement plan litigation. Welcome, Kim.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
As we look at this being the 45th anniversary of the enactment of ERISA, how has the world of retirement plan litigation evolved over the years?
Sure. So the most notable change that we've seen in retirement plan litigation, hands down, over the past few years is the considerable increase in 401k plan litigation starting around 2015. So between 2015 and 2017, we saw the greatest number of 401k lawsuits filed since the recession in 2008. These cases allege excessive investment and administrative fees, underperforming investment choices, and self-dealing. This started with 401k plans, but more recently, there's been a wave of litigation involving university 403b plans, but they involve the same set of allegations. This surge is probably due to the number of workers whose retirement assets are tied up in defined contribution plans. That seems to be where everyone has their retirement money these days, so that puts increased pressure on plan performance.
What are the current trends you're seeing with retirement plan litigation?
We've seen a mixed bag of results with the excessive fee 401k plan litigation. Some cases have been dismissed. There was one success for defendants at trial, but many of these cases have made it through the motion to dismiss stage, and have a lot of them have settled for high dollars. So we've seen some slowdown in this litigation, but I think it's still going to continue, and that's largely due to the high settlement dollars that we're seeing. But we have seen some other trends, some still involving 401k plans. We've seen quite a few lawsuits filed against small 401k plans. It seems to be the same plaintiff's firm doing that. That's involving plans with $100 million to $500 million in assets. And we're also seeing some new theories of liability for these defined contribution plans. One major theory is that participant data is a plan asset, and alleging that it's a breach of fiduciary duty to fail to protect and regulate the use of that data by service providers. We also seen claims alleging that a company's decision to include proprietary funds, that that decision was made to benefit the company and not in the participant's interest. But also defined benefit plans are seeing a new wave of litigation. These lawsuits challenge a plan sponsor's use of old and allegedly outdated mortality tables as unreasonable when performing actuarial assumptions for conversions of life annuities to other annuity forms. The theory is that mortality has improved, life expectancy has increased since the 1960s, so there should be more recent tables with longer life expectancy being used, and those will have more favorable numbers. So 9 lawsuits have been filed so far. Motions to dismiss have been filed in all of those. 2 decisions have been issued denying those motions to dismiss, so we'll see what the other courts do. But this is obviously very much in the beginning stages of this type of litigation, so we'll see what kind of success plaintiffs actually have. And then we're looking at some Supreme Court issues that the court's going to be taking up this term. One is the Salima versus Intel case, where the court is looking at what constitutes actual knowledge to trigger the 3-year versus the 6-year statute of limitations for breach of fiduciary duty claims. Basically, does a plan participant need to read financial and plan disclosures that he or she receives, or is it enough to just receive them to trigger actual knowledge? Also, in the Jander versus IBM case, the Supreme Court will examine or possibly clarify the Dudenhofer standard for stock drop cases. And in the Thole versus U.S. Bank case, the court will look at whether participants can sue for plan mismanagement when the plan has been fully funded.
Wow, 3 cases before the Supreme Court this year. Sounds like it'll be an exciting year for ERISA.
It will be an exciting year for ERISA attorneys, that's for sure. And yes, the court actually turned down 1 or 2 cases, and it may even be considering one still of whether it's going to take it up. But that raises a good issue, because there's a Ninth Circuit decision that just came out that we expect to see at least a petition to the Supreme Court pretty soon. The case was Dorman versus Charles Schwab, and it involved whether breach of fiduciary duty claims brought under ERISA 502A2 on behalf of the plan can be arbitrated on an individual basis. And that's what the Ninth Circuit found could happen. It upheld the enforceability of an arbitration provision and a class waiver provision in a defined contribution plan. And this is the first appellate ruling allowing arbitration of claims brought on behalf of the plan. Just last year, the Ninth Circuit issued a decision in Monroe versus USC, which did not permit the arbitration of such claims. But as the Ninth Circuit explained in Dorman, Monroe was different because the arbitration provision there was in an individual agreement. It was not in the plan itself, and an individual cannot bind the plan to arbitrate on behalf of itself. In Dorman, however, the arbitration provision was in the plan. So the court found the plan had consented to the arbitration by including it, and it was enforceable. We have seen plaintiffs has already filed a petition for rehearing en banc, but the Ninth Circuit has not yet. They haven't asked Schwab to issue a response, and we don't know if they'll actually take it up. But even if they don't, we expect plaintiffs to file a petition to the Supreme Court, although there is not a circuit split yet, so we don't know if the court will find it necessary to take it up at this time.
How have these trends impacted employers and how they offer benefits to their employees?
So I think the biggest takeaway for employers and plan sponsors has been that they really have to focus on their decision-making processes, because often and we really see this in the 401k plan cases, those decisions have not turned on whether investment returns were too low or whether fees were too high. They really focused on whether a prudent decision-making process was followed in deciding which fees to use, which service providers to use, and which investments to include in the plan. So what the courts are really looking at is, did you take the participant's best interest in mind in making those decisions? And with respect to how it's affected what benefits employers offer to their employees, it still seems as though they're going to offer the same benefits because defined contribution plans are so popular. It would be tough to not offer that to your employees, even though there's an increased risk of litigation. But I think really plan sponsors will just be focusing more on the prudent decision making that I just described so they can reduce their risk of liability.
What do clients need to be aware of in the next year or the next few years?
So that's always hard to predict, given, as you can see, plaintiffs counsel are always testing new theories and testing out the waters with new types of litigation. So I think the best thing to look out for is keeping abreast of those trends, talking to your employee benefits counsel, your litigation counsel, ask them what they've been seeing. That way you can at least identify the trends early on and make sure you're not susceptible to those.
Great. Thank you, Kim. We really appreciate your insights.
Thanks for having me.